right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. We have an intimate group around the table here today for the Medical Care Advisory Committee members. And Carla, if you could go ahead and call the roll, and then I'll get into it.
Okay, thank you. Andrea Gary for Cheryl Young with Department of Health. Jerry Cully, Department of Children and Families.
Here.
Madeline Nobles, Department of Elder Affairs.
Here.
Crystal Stickle with Florida Hospital Association.
Here.
Amy Liam, Florida Legal Services.
Here, on the phone.
Dr. Kathy Moffitt with the Florida Association of Health Plans. Dr. Richard Thacker with Florida Osteopathic Medical Association.
Here.
Dr. Robert Payne, Florida Dental Association.
Here.
Stan Whitaker with the Florida Association of Nurse Practitioners. Martha Pierce. Michael Lockwood.
All right, great. Well, thank you all for coming today. This is our summer quarterly meeting, and so we have quite a few updates for you today, but for once, we do not have a public meeting that we're doing in conjunction with this or anything like that, so it's a little bit of a simpler format than we sometimes have. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and get into it. It's going to be all me today, so I'm just going to walk you through a number of different program updates, and I've got my team here with me, Siobhan Harris and Abby Riddle, to assist with anything that I get wrong, and so they will kick me under the table if I get it wrong. So I think most people... Yes, and just a reminder for folks on the phone, if you could please mute your phone unless you are talking. That will help everybody be able to hear better. So, and please do speak up if you're having trouble hearing us as well. All right, we're not projecting up on the screen today. I apologize, but I think folks in the audience have a copy of the presentation that we'll be walking through, and folks on the phone should have it posted on our website, and Carla has sent you the link. So we'll just start out... by going through, I wanted to make sure that you understood our leadership structure. We have had a couple changes recently, so I wanted to point out a few of those. But on the first slide, which is slide number 2 in your deck, this is just our basic org chart for Medicaid. And it shows who I consider my leadership team that I work most closely with. So I have 4 direct reports who are managers, and each one of those, 3 of those are assistant deputy secretaries. 2 of them are here with me, Abby and Siobhan, and I think you've heard from both of them at various times, and also Dan McCleary, who's over data and analytics. And then each of them have bureau chiefs that report to them. And I just wanted to point out 2 changes in the bureau chiefs. One under Abby is Eunice Medina, and she has presented to this group before. Eunice is the new bureau chief for plan management operations. So she is overseeing all of our contracts with the health plans and the day-to-day management of those contracts. So I'm very happy to have promoted her to that position. And then also under Siobhan in the Bureau of Medicaid Policy and succeeding Siobhan in that role is Erica Floyd Thomas, who I think many of you also know as well, longtime employee, as is Eunice, and taking over the role of policy. So that includes all of the home and community-based waivers, all of the 1115 waivers, the development of the managed care plan contracts, all of our coverage policies and fee schedules and so on. So all of our rules, regulations, federal contracts, and so forth. So very pleased to have both of them stepping up into even higher leadership roles. So please welcome them to that role if you see them. And does anyone have any questions about our org structure or anything? I just thought sometimes it's helpful to know who people are and where they belong in the organization. Okay. Okay. So the next big update is on our 1115 waiver. I think most of you know that our 1115 Managed Medical Assistance waiver is the waiver that operates our the medical portion of our managed care program. And this is an 1115 waiver, which just means that is a research and demonstration project. It is the most flexible type of authority that we can get from the federal government. And in December, we submitted a request to extend that waiver for 5 more years. And we did actually get that granted last week on August the 3rd. So that extension will run through June of 2022. So we do have a 5-year extension on that to continue our program. It was essentially the same, pretty much the same terms and conditions as before, a lot of technical kinds of things that matter to us behind the scenes, but don't change the structure of the program at all. The one big change was in the low-income pool. And so I did want to talk a little bit about that. The low-income pool, or LIP as it's commonly known, did increase from about $600 million to $1.5 billion. And LIP is a uncompensated care pool. It is for hospitals and other providers to draw on if they can put up matching funds in order to draw down for uncompensated care, so the charity care that they provide. It does not include a lot of other kinds of things that it has included in the past. The LIP has been around for over a decade and has changed a lot over the time, but it does not any longer include things like coverage for insured individuals, bad debt, or what is often called Medicaid or CHIP shortfall. And that's really not changed from the last time. What's really the change is the amount. So it's more than double what it is, and so the hospitals could actually earn the entirety of their uncompensated care back if they can put up the match. And it does allow some other additional categorization into tiers, which will be helpful to the hospitals as they try to draw down this funding. We are in the process of submitting, putting together a budget amendment to submit to the House and the Senate for approval here in Florida. And we'll have a public meeting on this next week to present some ideas on models to our stakeholders to get additional feedback. We've been working with them all summer. So, yes, Dr. Thacker.
Yes, thank you. Just for informational purposes, I participate in training medical students. And so I was just curious if in the future if someone could get me the breakdown on the LIP funds distribution. I'm particularly interested in the medical school distribution.
Okay. We can do that. Okay. Any other questions from the members on LIP or the renewal of the waiver?
Yes, this is Dr. Payne. I'm pleasantly surprised about the increase in LIP pool because, if my memory serves me, weren't the LIP funds threatened to be held hostage in the past if Florida did not expand their Medicaid?
Yeah, they were never held hostage, but they were reduced considerably. And so the formula that the previous federal administration used to calculate the amount of LIP funds brought us from about $1 billion down to $600 million. And the reason for that was that they took out compensation for the group that they said would have been covered if Florida had chosen to expand Medicaid coverage. That group has been added back in, and that's part of the reason why we can get to $1.5 billion.
So has Florida been forgiven for not expanding?
I think you'll have to ask the feds for that, but I think the numbers speak for themselves. So, definitely a different administration that we're working with. So. Okay, and then the other big thing that we're doing on statewide Medicaid managed care is reprocuring the health plan contracts for the next 5 years. So this is a large undertaking. This is an 18-month endeavor to reprocure the health plans. We put out an invitation to negotiate, which is the most flexible form of procurement that we can do, and we released that on July the 14th. We are in what's known as a blackout period, which is a statutory requirement. That means that during this time period, from the point that we release the ITN through 72 hours after the time that we award it, nobody can contact us about this except through our procurement officer. If they do, they are have the possibility of being disqualified from the procurement. So we're very careful then during this period about how we talk about it, who we talk to, and so forth. But I do want to give you a couple of highlights from it to kind of help you guide you through. It is posted for anybody who wants to see. It's a lengthy document. It includes a draft contract, which is a couple hundred pages, as well as a lot of instructions to the respondents and the various questions that they and scenarios that they need to respond to. Just to give you an overview of the timing on this, the vendors have responses due in the beginning of November. And then there is a time period that I want to highlight where providers, Medicaid providers, can give us feedback on the bidders. So let's say that we have, just to pick a number, 10 bidders. We will put out the names of those bidders and the regions that they've bid in. And then there will be a short survey monkey, I think it's just three or four questions, that ask for the provider's experience with those different managed care plans on things like prior authorization processes, the process of becoming a network provider, billing and payment types of issues. And it's really just a simple kind of rating scale. That actually gets tabulated together and it becomes part of the scoring of the plans. So when that happens, that will be, at this point, we will be putting it out probably a couple days after we receive all the bids in and we have the list of who has bid, and then we'll put it out and there'll probably be about 2 weeks for providers to respond. So when that happens, we'll definitely be getting it out to everybody's groups to make sure, you know, your members have an opportunity to comment on the groups that are seeking to do business with the state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you say it goes out to every provider.
Hold on a second.
Have concerns about a health care facility?
That's not me. That's somebody.
Contact the agency complaint hotline at 1-888-419-3456 or complete the health care facility.
Your line has been muted.
aca.myflorida.com.
Your line has been unmuted.
Hello?
Hi. Folks on the phone, we're trying to find a way to mute the people who have put us on hold. Okay. I think that's it. Folks on the phone, if you could please, somebody just put us on hold or picked up another call, and that automatically puts us on hold. And I'm sorry to say it was an agency employee because we heard the agency's hold music. So please be mindful of that. I do know that sometimes it's you don't realize that if you pick up another phone call, it puts us automatically on hold. Okay, thank you. All right. I know because I've done that before on a national conference call. So we've all had our moment, right? Okay, and the lovely voice you heard is our own Millie Markey in the back there, in case you did not connect that, if you've ever been on hold. And Millie is the voice of ACA. Okay, so and then we will, back to the ITN. The notice of intent to award for our contracts will be in April. So it is a lengthy process on that. Crystal, you had a question there.
It's totally fine. So will the provider survey go out to each individual Medicaid, hospital, or generally for anybody? It won't be tracked, essentially.
Correct. It'll be posted online. Any provider can do. We are going to ask providers to put in their provider number.
Okay.
So there will be an identification. If we see any kind of strangeness with that, obviously we can track it then at that point.
Okay.
But it will be more generally posted, and then we'll be looking for people to respond. So that would be helpful if folks who have associations could get that information out to their members.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll be sending that information out through all the means that we have to distribute information.
Very good.
In order to get the most responses. Now, these are, by statute, they are 11 separate regional procurements. So we procure on a regional basis. The regions did not change, and so they are the same as they are currently. And there is they are being procured together with long-term care and medical services being procured together. This is different from last time. Last time, they were two separate procurement tracks. And there are four possible plan types that that entities can bid as. The first is comprehensive, which we have now. This is that they would provide the medical or the MMA services to all members, plus they would be providing long-term care services to anybody who qualifies for the long-term care services. A new plan type that we've put out in this ITN is called Long-Term Care Plus, and this would be a plan that provides services only to people who need long-term care. But for those people, they would also provide all the medical services. So a person who needs long-term care would get all of the services that they need from Medicaid from one entity. Okay, so it's really long-term care with the medical services wrapped around for that population. And then there will be MMA-only plans, which we have now, who only provide the medical services. And then finally, there will be, again, the opportunity for specialty plans to bid, as we have now. And these are managed medical assistance plans that only serve certain populations. So we currently have plans for people with HIV/AIDS, people with serious mental illness, children with chronic conditions, and a child welfare specialty plan. Yeah. So, well, if you can hold your questions till the end, we'll see if we have time after the members have a chance to talk. Okay. Okay, so those are the four different types that the bidders can bid as. Yeah, Crystal, go.
So I recall previously you could have a scenario where you could have one of your dual eligibles have basically two different providers, right? So you'd have one plan maybe on the MMA side, but then another plan on the long-term care side. Is your LTC Plus to kind of consolidate that to
yes.
avoid have somebody having potentially three cards if they had a Medicare plan as well?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, so the idea is to move towards plans that provide all of the Medicaid services that a person needs under one plan.
So you won't have that scenario.
Correct.
Anymore.
There will Perfect. No longer be a scenario where someone could get their Medicaid long-term care services from one plan and their Medicaid medical services
yeah.
from a different plan.
I think that's a great improvement.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. All right, so we did also do some focusing in this contract on some goals that we have set going forward. So we've been doing some strategic planning within Medicaid to set our goals for the next, really for the next 6.5 years at this point, because this will take us through the end of the next contracts. And there are three areas where we've set quality improvement goals. The first is to reduce potentially preventable healthcare events. And by this, we mean preventing unnecessary hospital admissions and readmissions, unnecessary use of the emergency department, and also the unnecessary use of ancillary services. Second area is to improve birth outcomes. And then the third area is to continue the rebalancing of long-term care services away from institutional-based services, nursing facilities, and towards community-based services, which is where people prefer to be served. So these are our three major goals. And if you care to read the ITN, which some of you are already doing, I'm sure, and others will never do, which is fine as well. But I can assure you that if you look through it, you will see these goals permeating throughout the responses, and we're asking our bidders to think very carefully about how they would help us advance these goals in the next 5-year contract cycle.
This is Dr. Thacker. So the I think they're great goals. I'm supportive of that and everything. I wouldn't want us to have to necessarily reinvent the wheel, you know, from a Medicare standpoint on a federal level, of course. You know, there's already mechanisms in place and processes. So I assume we're kind of dovetailing into that or utilizing that. And if not, you know, where are we in terms of innovation, you know, for particular needs of Florida's residents?
Yeah. I'll skip ahead a little bit to something that's later in the presentation because I think it fits in really well here on the potentially preventable events. So the members, you have at your place this report, which is our spring business intelligence report. For those of you in the audience, this is posted on our website. If you're having trouble finding it, let us know. This is all about potentially preventable healthcare events in Florida, and it takes the first full year of data that we had from the SMMC program and looked at, ran it through a software that's developed by 3M that looks at potentially preventable events and sliced and diced the data a lot of different ways. So it's done by region, by our 11 AHCA regions, it's done by health plan, it's done by children versus adults, people with disabilities and elders versus kids. And so a lot of different looks at the data to say, where are our opportunities for improvement on potentially preventable healthcare events? Now, everybody understands that not all hospitalizations are inappropriate, not all admissions or readmissions are avoidable, all of those things. But there is plenty of room for improvement as we look at the data. We're actually working already on the follow-up year of data. It took us several years to develop the infrastructure and technology and know-how to run this report, but we're already developing the next one, so we'll be able to see if there was any change from year one to year two. But what we can see here is that there's a lot of opportunities. So to your point, Dr. Thacker, our goal is to work with folks who are out there already working on it. We've been talking with the hospital associations. We need to bring in the physicians into the conversation, and we've been engaging the health plans already to say there's a lot of opportunity here. One of the things from the report that I think is particularly illuminating is that 70% of our emergency department visits by Medicaid recipients are potentially preventable. So that's you know, no matter how you may think that there might be some gray areas in the data, there's a lot of percentage points that are not gray at all. So we know there's opportunities here to improve quality and contain costs. And so, Medicare, for example, I think just put out, I saw the news article today on hospitals that are going to have to pay a penalty for not getting their readmission rates to where their targets were. So we know that there are opportunities to piggyback on things that are already happening out there. On birth outcomes, we partner closely with the Florida Perinatal Quality Collaborative that's based out of USF that works with hospitals across the state to improve birth outcomes and the Healthy Start coalitions. So we're looking for partnerships. We're not going to start from scratch here, but we want to be partnering with anybody who's interested in this moving forward. The first step was to put out the report. Second step was to put the goals out into the procurement. And then the third step will be to get those responses back from the plans and start building initiatives around this. So, yeah. Crystal.
Question.
Okay. Talk all you want.
So I haven't read this. I actually found it on your website earlier this week and printed and was trying to read through it, and I saw it this morning in printed copy. So I haven't gotten all the way through it, but am I to assume that this is really just a look back of what has already occurred, and then in the procurement you're trying to figure out the policies or the ways that we could take this data we have and reduce the events that we're trying to reduce going forward in the next round of ITN?
Yeah, this is look back. This is actually
14-15
data, and the next set would be 15-16 data. And then these are just establishing baselines so that people can start to get familiar with it and get to some ideas about where might be the most fruitful areas to approach it. Mm-hmm. You know, do we focus on kids? Do we focus on adults? Etc.
And then as far as I'm looking here at like the things that you're considering, right, like ambulatory sensitive, nurse sitting sensitive, where it talks about the different ways that you're looking at it, is this something that is kind of a set parameter by the 3M software, or is this something that, hey, we see something that looks a little different in Florida, could we put that in as something to monitor or watch or use in the evaluation of whichever set we're looking at trying to evaluate, be it readmissions or ED visits?
For the purposes of this report, this is strictly based off of the algorithm that's been built by 3M in conjunction with providers over many years.
Mm-hmm.
So as we learned about it, we felt pretty confident that it was pretty generalizable. That said, we can always be flexible as we go forward and start to set goals for Florida. If there's something about the algorithm that doesn't work, we can take a look at that. At this point, it's really just starting the conversation.
And then the last thing I would say, just coming from the hospital perspective, especially around the emergency room stuff, we want to work with you all, and I think we've had conversations mm-hmm. about things that we know are out there, and our colleagues in other states have
yep.
used, like E is for emergencies, and
yes.
how successful that's been. but one of the big concerns we have is just in the way that it gets applied, right? So if something is a PPE, we get it, but we just don't want it to become something that is just automatically a non-payment issue from the plan perspective, that it's a more thoughtful and collaborative process that we're on both sides trying to address something. I mean, we don't ask people to come to the ER in most cases when some people advertise, I know, but we generally don't seek for them to come to the ED, especially for something like a sore throat or some of these cases or things that you're pointing out, which I think is really fascinating and very excited to have this kind of data. But we would just really like to make sure that it is something that gets implemented when it comes down to how it works, especially when it comes to payment for the provider side, that it isn't kind of a punishment when we haven't had a role to play in something. Certainly in readmissions, understand that. But some of these areas, we don't ask for somebody to come to the ER and wouldn't want it to be used in a draconian fashion against hospitals.
And we hear you on that. We really do want this to be a collaboration and that everybody is pulling together. Like I said, we're not at the point where we're draining the last bits of, you know, efficiency out of the system and we're in some kind of gray area. There's tons of room to work here where there's no question that that outcomes could be improved and that would also likely result in some cost savings to the program. And so that's really why we're tackling this. We want to make sure that everybody's pulling together on this, that it's a collaborative effort and not a, you know, just a, you know, we set goals and we expect everybody to go out there and figure it out on their own. We're going to be very involved in this to make sure everybody's partnering. Yeah, Dr. Thacker.
One of the entities that we tend not to talk too much about from a Medicaid perspective is home health care agencies, but they're really extremely important in from the Medicare side of trying to prevent readmissions. I know that not most home health care agencies don't accept Medicaid, but if we could try to bring them into the fold. The long-term care facilities, particularly on the subacute side, these are the, once again, the Medicare side, these are the folks with short-term rehab. So they're invested in this and they're working at it. They're trying to promote what their readmission rate is, trying to compare themselves to other facilities in a particular geographical area. So, and it's to their benefit to show that because they want those referrals. Same with the home health care folks. So I'd like to see us try to incorporate that, and I'll just throw something out, you know, here is that I work better with a carrot rather than a stick. I'm not a big fan on the punitive aspects, and we're going to dock you or we're going to cut your reimbursement rate. And I know you're not saying that, but that we've said that in regards to the feds. But a positive thing, a carrot may be that, you know, we have with certain hospital associations or start with individual hospitals, whichever you want, and just have someone that's dedicated for those patients with Medicaid, whether they're dual eligible or not, but the Medicaid patients to have a caseworker or a discharge planner, and that's their primary focus so that they can be well-schooled, you know, in how to manage these patients. For instance, at my hospital here in Tallahassee, Capital Region Medical Center, we have somebody that's dedicated for VA patients, you know, and the TRICARE aspect of it, because they have particular needs. There's discharge plannings and issues and payment issues, you know, and that sort of thing. And that's worked so much better once we had that dedicated person. Now, they can certainly do other aspects of discharge planning for other people. So just something to think about. It may not be as expensive as, you know, at least as a starter project, may not be that expensive to help fund a position at a hospital. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thacker. I think those are great ideas. This is something that you all can engage with the health plans now on. They are developing their bids. There is no prohibition of you talking to them about what they're developing and what kinds of things they're putting forward. So I'll just reiterate that in their responses, they are going to have to address many of these aspects in terms of what will they be bringing to the table. So, you know, if they're, this is a good time to try to partner with them and come up with solutions that you all can bring together on that. We'll be looking for them to bring their ideas to the table, and they'll be scored on that. So this is a great time to be bringing these thoughts to the table with the potential bidders. Okay. If you want to know who the potential bidders are, we don't know all of them, but we did have a non-binding request for letters of intent a couple months ago. Those are all posted on our website, and if you need that list, we can have Carla get that out to you. A couple other things about the procurement. We did put a number of other additional enhancements in there throughout in terms of the provider experience with the health plan, making sure that there's appropriate training, that the plans are engaged in good dispute resolution practices with the providers, and some aspects about credentialing the providers to get them through the process perhaps a little bit quicker into the plan's networks. Some strengthening of subcontractor oversight. A lot of the key things that the plans do are done through subcontractors, and so there's some strengthening there. And then also some strengthening around claims payment, timeliness, and reporting and transparency for the providers as well. So it's a great opportunity for us to strengthen the program, and we're looking forward to seeing what the plans bring to the table to negotiations. The other thing that is happening is another procurement, which will come hard on the heels of this ITN that we put out this summer. This will be for the prepaid dental plans. I think you all know that the legislature took action a year ago in the session before last to carve dental services out of managed medical assistance, and so that will be happening in conjunction with the rollout of the statewide Medicaid managed care plan new contracts. So that will be either late 2018 or early 2019. And so when we go live with the new contracts, we'll also go live with prepaid dental and dental services being separate from managed medical assistance. So we are currently working on the procurement for a release later this fall. We anticipate that the program would cover all dental services that are currently covered by the state plan, and that all eligible adults and children enrolled in Medicaid will be part of those prepaid dental health plans for their dental services. We did put out what we call a request for information, which is really just an all call to anybody who wants to tell us their great ideas, and we did receive 15 responses. We're in the process right now of talking to all of the respondents and just getting them to elaborate a little bit on some of the ideas and suggestions that they put forward in their RFI, and that helps inform us as we put together the procurement so we kind of get the best, everybody's best thinking on it going forward. All right, so any questions about the procurement of SMMC or prepaid dental rollout? Okay, that's a lot on that. Okay, everything else is under miscellaneous, so but there's a lot here, so I'll I talk fast, so tell me if you need me to slow down. So the first thing that I wanted to talk about is one of my favorite things to talk about in Medicaid, which is the increase in our continuing increase in our quality scores. So we have just received the HEDIS results from the plans. These are the healthcare effectiveness data and information set, which are nationally recognized quality metrics for health plans. And on the left-hand side of the slide, what you have is a comparison from the time period before statewide Medicaid managed care to the most current data that we have, which is for calendar year 2016. And what it shows is that we are now at 53% of the measures that we measure being above the national average. So it has continued to grow every year since we've gone to SMMC. A lot of times in the past couple years, we've actually said at or above the national average. Now we're just talking about above the national average. So these ones were better than average. So we're very proud of this. It continues to go up. And we selected a couple of measures here where you could kind of show the contrast. Follow-up after hospitalization for mental illness, that's follow-up within 7 days, is still too low, but it is getting much, much better. There's been a lot of focus on that. Dental visit, this is something we put a tremendous amount of effort into over the last several years, and that we hope this trajectory will continue with the prepaid dental plans, even if they're carved out. We're now actually above the national average for the children getting an annual dental visit, so something to be really proud of. We went from being last in the nation on this to not being last in the nation, so very good. The well child visits in the first 15 months as critical months when the child with newborns, continuing to go up as well. Lead screening, something that people didn't pay a lot of attention to in recent years, especially in Florida because we don't have old housing stock and we don't have lead pipes and things, but with the influx of toys that potentially have lead in them, lead screening is again becoming an important issue, for especially for low-income children who might be getting toys that are lower quality, unfortunately. And then immunizations for adults for adolescents getting up there, and women getting prenatal care also showing great improvement. So very proud of these results. We expect to see these continue. Our health plans are putting a lot of energy into this, and there are both carrots and sticks behind this, so we do think that that matters. Okay. Yeah, Dr. Thacker.
Is there somewhere where the data that you're collecting says what the top two or three limiting factors are from, you know, achieving higher numbers? And I'm very pleased, you know, to see this, but higher numbers or in the categories where, you know, the other 47% where we're, you know, not above the average. Where would we find, or how would we know what the real limiting factors are for each of those?
Now, it's not really data that's collected. These are strictly based on, you know, claims data and counter data from the plan. So they are objective measures. And the kinds of things that you'd be looking for would be things that we would get from discussions with the health plans. So one of the ways that we do that under Siobhan's group, we have a quality bureau that spends a lot of time working with the plans on their initiatives. And for example, on dental, we focused on dental and on well-child visits in the first 15 months of life. And so they go in depth with the plan saying, what kinds of strategies are you trying? What's working? How well are you measuring those? And how often are you, you know, adjusting your strategies if they're not showing results? So through that and through group stakeholder work, so for example, we're part of a number of oral health coalitions in the state where we've really gotten into the grassroots talking with people about what the barriers are. So we can't do it for every, you know, we can't go that in depth on every area, which is why we've chosen those areas of focus. So we'll continue our focus on birth outcomes, and that includes both prenatal care, also working on things like access to long-acting reversible contraception so that women can plan their births, so that we don't have, for example, substance abuse, women who have substance abuse disorders getting pregnant unintentionally, those types of things. So those are all things that we're working on, but we do kind of focus our areas in a couple areas. Lately, last couple years, dental, it's been a huge focus, and the well-child visits in the first 15 months of life have been two areas of focus for us. Going forward, we will work on the potentially preventable events and continue our focus on birth outcomes.
Okay, and that's great. So what I'd be kind of interested in what are patterns or trends, you know. So if, you know, part of it is, and this is, you know, this is not necessarily proven, but you're going to find a lot of providers will say, well, this is, you know, it's a compliance issue on somebody's part. And maybe it isn't, you know, maybe it's a transportation issue, you know, or maybe they, you know, somebody just didn't know, or maybe there's not enough providers in that area, for instance, you know, follow-up after hospitalization for mental illness within 7 days, you know, but you've got a limited number of providers and they're booked up for 3 months, you know, so it's going to be hard to, you know, achieve that. And it's not that it's not impossible, but then, you know, somebody on the other end is going to have to say, well, what is the incentive to maybe keep some block time open, you know, for some of these folks, you know, things like that. So that's what I'd be interested in, is just kind of general patterns. Mm-hmm. And what kind of brainstorming is going on in regards to the, you know, how to solve that. Thanks.
Sure. And these are things that our subcommittees can talk more in depth about as well, in areas of focus. I know our dental committee subcommittee talks about that quite a bit, the types of things that we're doing and learning on these. But yes, it's not usually a silver bullet. It's not usually one thing. It's a combination of factors, everything from recipients not valuing or understanding the need for the service, to not being able to access it due to complicated lives, lack of transportation, difficulty reaching the providers, and so on all the way down line. Sometimes it's a data issue where it's just not being reported. I mean, so we've seen all of these things and more as we dig into them, and it's usually a series of small steps forward rather than one giant leap, although occasionally we see that as well. So that that can be very exciting when we see that, but it tends to be a little bit slower and more incremental. But we have seen a steady uptick across the board, so it's very gratifying.
Yep.
Okay. The next is a couple of slides. I'm going to talk about waiver consolidation. So this is an initiative that was something that we brought to the legislature, and the legislature has directed us to do through statute last session. And we will be combining several of our home and community-based service waivers into existing programs. So these are the Project AIDS Care Waiver, the Traumatic Brain and Spinal Cord Injury Waiver, and the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Waiver. These will all be transitioned into other waivers by January 1st. So just across the board, I want to say that there will be no adverse impact to recipients from these changes. They're not going to have any change in their eligibility for Medicaid. They won't be changing their services, and they won't be moving into nursing facilities. These are all things that people are worried about, and we want to just reassure up front that those are not things that will happen because of this change. We're doing a lot of outreach to the stakeholders. We've started individual calls to people who are affected. We are talking with case management agencies that work with these individuals. We have a series of webinars every month for each of the different groups that are affected. And we're going to just continue to do that outreach. But if there are people who have questions or concerns, we'd want to make sure that you're coming to us with those concerns. We're posting more information every day on our website so that people can follow along with this. But I just wanted you to be aware of that. It is a major change. The Project AIDS Care waiver has a bit over 7,000 people in it. The other waivers are much smaller, about 400 people in brain and spinal cord injury, less than that, under 400, and then just 100 or so in cystic fibrosis waiver. So they'll continue, those people who need home and community-based services will continue to get them. They'll get them through the long-term care program. And those who do not need long-term care services will continue to get their eligibility at the higher income threshold that is allowed under waivers. So again, nobody's losing eligibility, nobody's losing services, just getting them into a more appropriate place, into the programs that have more accountability and more services available. The next one is switching gears again. So I think most of you know that when the statewide Medicaid managed care program was put into statute, there was a provision that stated that the managed care plans needed to use the efficiencies that they gained by good coordination of care and good management of care and reinvest that into physician compensation so that physicians would be reimbursed at the Medicare rate based on the savings that were achieved through the managed care program. So we started this program last year, last fall, and in the very first year, the physicians who could qualify for the incentive payments were board certified pediatricians and board certified OBGYNs that met certain quality or access criteria. So, for example, pediatricians who had a patient centered medical home designation could qualify under many of the different plans, and OBGYNs had some quality outcome criteria as well. So each of the plans was able to create their own program based around those basic parameters. Now going into looking ahead to year two, which will start this fall, we are expanding the program based on the savings from the program. And we will be the pediatricians will be able to earn the incentive, family practitioners who serve children, and general practice physicians who serve children as well. Those will all be able to be eligible regardless of whether or not they're board certified, as long as they meet the quality criteria established by the plans. We are also expanding to five different board certified pediatric subspecialties, so cardiologists, endocrinologists, nephrologists, neurologists, and psychiatrists. So it's a major expansion of the groups that can qualify, and I think we're close to putting out the parameters on the website. Do you know where we are on that?
I can't find out.
Okay, sorry to put you on the spot. But very soon, all the parameters for the different plans will be out. Anybody who qualified last year, those parameters will still be in place. You can still qualify the same way. Some plans are adding some additional ways to qualify in addition to adding the different groups who can qualify. So overall, more physicians will be eligible starting in October of this year.
When you talk about the different specialists within pediatrics that you're going to include, did you base that off access issues or where you saw that we didn't have enough here in certain regions to determine which ones that you wanted to include?
Yes, we did. We couldn't get to all specialists with the amount of savings that we had this year, especially with the major expansion to the other categories, but we did start picking ones where we thought that we needed some more. We would like to see more participating in the program.
So the Dr. Thacker again, criteria, you know, in terms of qualifications and that sort of thing, is there something particular, you know, is it above and beyond what's, you know, the sign up that you have to do to be a Medicaid provider, and is any of that based on the number of you know, patients that you have in your practice or number of encounters in the past? Can you speak to any of the qualifications that you're looking for?
I'm sure, Dr. Thacker, it does vary by plan, which is why I can't illuminate, you know, all of them. But, for example, many of the plans last year adopted, if they were a patient-centered medical home, then they qualified. Some of them had criteria that were based on HEDIS measures. Some of them had criteria that were based on diversion from emergency department or emergency department utilization. Those are some of the major types of criteria that we saw. So
as a follow-up to that, it's not necessarily a volunteer thing on the physician's standpoint. Is it more the plans try to recruit the doctors they need or want, you know, in that particular area, or is the onus on the physician to want to participate?
The onus is on the plan, and if the physician meets the criteria, they will get paid the higher rate. So the physician doesn't, you know, the plans reach out to the physicians who they think qualify and notify them, and then they work through that arrangement.
Right, and so just so I'm clear on that, it's, you know, you don't want the doctors calling up saying, hey, I want to be on this. It's more of the plan is going to ask you.
Right. I think that's true, but I would encourage physicians to look at the criteria that for the plans that have been approved for the plans that they contract with, if they're not hearing from the plan about it in the near future, then they should raise their hand and say we have had instances where a provider did qualify and the plan had overlooked them for some reason. So those can get rectified as long as someone speaks up about it. So, yeah. We do require that they pay retroactively if that kind of situation is uncovered. So, okay. Okay, and then the next two slides should be fairly familiar to you. This is just an update on our complaints that we received through our centralized complaint operations center. The first slide is complaints from recipients. I think the last time that we met, we were encountering a little bit of a spike, and Abby had talked through that. Seems to have come back down to more normal levels since that little uptick, and looking pretty normal at this point in terms of recipient complaints, steady state. The next one is provider complaints. And again, these are, although they go up and down over a little bit over the months, they are pretty steady as well. All right, and I'm actually coming near to the end of my update, but hang in there. The last thing is on prospective payment systems, which this has to do with our fee-for-service environment, and we have been moving the way that we pay institutional providers, that is hospitals and nursing facilities, towards a type of payment system that is no longer based on cost reports, which look back retroactively and calculate rates based on individual cost reports, and doing methodology that we call prospective, so we set a rate looking forward. We have about 2 or 3 years ago, Crystal, when we went to DRGs, which is for hospitals, diagnosis-related groups for hospital inpatient care. This July, we went to a prospective payment called Enhanced Ambulatory Payment Groups for Outpatient Hospital, and that was implemented July 1. Again, these are legislatively mandated changes. And then finally, nursing facility is the next group that will go next July. This was a legislative change where the legislature has directed us to adopt a prospective payment model for nursing facilities starting next summer. We are convening a work group that the legislature directed us to convene this summer. We are in the process right now of picking work group members and notifying them. And the idea is just to go back over some of the areas that were where there's still some disagreement in the industry about how the model should look, and then we'll be reporting on that December 1st to the legislature. So it'll be a pretty quick work group, but we will be announcing those members in the near future. And then it's actually October of next year that would be implemented with that new payment system. So pretty big deal for those industries and a pretty large change for us as well in terms of the way that we set rates. The next slide is what I already talked about, which is the potentially preventable event report. I encourage you all to look for that. Our website can sometimes be a little challenging. It's so full of good information that it's sometimes hard to find where things are. So if you're having trouble finding it, it is under the Business Intelligence Unit. and it is potentially a preventable healthcare event report. So we've talked about that a little bit, but we're very excited about this and the possibilities for quality improvement that would come from this data. So with that, I'm going to stop talking and let you all have questions or comments. Are folks on the phone able to speak up? I'm hoping that I didn't mute you inadvertently.
Yes, I'm here. Thanks. That's a great presentation.
Okay, great. Just every once in a while, I wonder if I lose people on the phone. So, all right, great. Okay, I know we had a question from the audience. So, Chris, if you could say your question, I'll repeat it for the folks on the phone.
Where the specialty plans for the re-procurement, do they count against the number of plans per region? You know, there's kind of a limit.
So the question has to do with specialty plans and whether they count towards a limit in an area. I'm actually not going to answer that here, Chris, because we are, as we start to get into back and forth, I can talk to you about the procurement. I can't really kind of sort of take input and give it back to you on it. So if that is a question that may come in through the procurement process, we're currently accepting questions and we will respond in writing to all the questions that we receive. So I'm not actually going to answer questions about the procurement due to the blackout.
Okay.
And I'll tell you whether I can answer it or not. Sure.
Okay. Select the new, what is it, 11-4? Select the re-procurement, the new system. You're going to select the winners?
Yes.
But when does it get implemented? When is the actual start date for the new set of MMAs? Is that
Yeah, the question is, when will we actually implement the new contracts? It'll be late 2018 or early 2019. Any other questions or concerns? Carla, do we need to do minutes or anything like that? Are we good?
The minutes were sent to members, and the majority have gotten back with me on their approval of the minutes. We do not have a quorum today for voting on them at the meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So hearing no other concerns or questions, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you all so much for your participation. Appreciate it.